Liberia struggles to contain Ebola. Today, Monday, August 18th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Locals storm a clinic treating contagious Ebola victims in Liberia's capital, Monrovia.
The community sort of turned on the clinic and said that Ebola was a hoax and overran the facility, bringing all of the people who'd been contained inside out.
And later, a picturesque Scottish island where cell phones do not work. Sort of sounds like heaven, but not for much longer, perhaps.
It's one of these sort of places where you can just chill out, but then you're pressurized now into being modern or upbeat or whatever they want to call it.
Plus, what kind of beast sounds like this? The answer, just ahead.
Support for PRI's The World comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Truth, they say, is the first casualty of war. And as you'll hear, truth seems to be taking a beating in the war in West Africa against Ebola. Imagine denial of the disease so high that people would say it's all a hoax and then overrun an Ebola isolation unit to let all the patients out. That actually happened this weekend in a neighborhood of Monrovia, the capital of Liberia. Overall, the Ebola outbreak has killed more than 1,000 people in West Africa since March. Some 400 of those dead have been from Liberia. And today, the Liberian government is worried that after that attack on the isolation unit, some of those missing Ebola patients could be spreading the disease farther afield. Gina Moore is a reporter for BuzzFeed. She's currently on assignment in Monrovia, where we reached her this morning. I asked her to describe what happened at the Ebola clinic in Monrovia on Saturday.
So I had been at the clinic earlier that morning just to sort of poke around and understand exactly what was going on. The clinic opened on Thursday, so 2 days before this happened. And it was opened because the community there, West Point, the cases are accelerating there. They're seeing more and more cases, and there's concern by the health authorities here that it is becoming a hot spot of the outbreak here in Monrovia. And so this center had been set up to hold people who had symptoms that led families or friends or concerned neighbors to think that they may have Ebola. When you're symptomatic, you can be contagious. So it's really important to remove people from proximity in those moments. And that's what this holding center was doing, trying to give a place for people who are exhibiting symptoms to wait while they got tested. And then those confirmed cases would be sent on to a proper case management or treatment facility. That was the idea, but there's a lot of fear and misapprehension and misunderstanding of Ebola in Liberia. And so after 2 days, the community sort of turned on the clinic, turned really on the idea of Ebola and said they didn't want Ebola in West Point, that Ebola was a hoax, and overran the facility, bringing all of the people who'd been contained inside out.
Now, Gina, you said Ebola is accelerating in this part of Monrovia, in West Point, and I think part of that is probably because of what this place is. It's one of the poorest slums in all of Africa. Describe West Point and what it looks like.
The visual is very much an informal community. There's one road, essentially one paved road that moves through it, and then the neighborhood really branches off from there very organically. People have erected their homes, and their homes are usually one room, maybe two room corrugated metal structures, wherever they have a spot to erect them. So if you're moving between houses, you know, sometimes you're doing a little bit of a shimmy as you move from what is essentially one person's front yard to another. You know, no one has toilet facilities in their home. There's no formal power grid. There's no running water. So it's a really challenged place. It's a community known for being resource challenged and having quite a few grievances in the best of times.
Not conducive to hygiene, to say the least.
That is certainly one of the challenges.
Gina, we've been asking reporters in these Ebola-stricken areas how they're coping with the hygiene and protecting themselves. But I'm also curious how you've got an understanding of microbes and contagion. How do you react when you speak with somebody in Monrovia who doesn't believe Ebola is real, who says it's a hoax? What do you tell them?
Well, there's, if they don't believe it already, they're sure not going to believe it from me as a white foreigner who showed up a week ago and is not a public health person. That's, you know, without question. I think that these feelings that Ebola is not real, that it's a hoax, these denialist feelings come not just from a place of misunderstanding or ignorance about the disease. They're much more deeply about distrust and about fear. And there's been suspicion and distrust of authority in general in Liberia for years and years and years and years. This is a country that went through a really brutal, nasty war period in very recent memory. And that affects how people feel day to day about the way society is organized and run, regardless of who's running it. This is a disease that has never appeared in this country before. It is brand new, and it is quite a killer. It shows up, you might not even know that you have it, and then 2 days later, you're dead. So it's a terrifying thing to experience. And of course, when you're responding to something terrifying and unknown, there's a lot of doubt and suspicion and fear.
Gina Moore is the global women's rights reporter for BuzzFeed. She's on assignment in Monrovia. Thank you very much for your time, Gina.
Thank you.
So that's a scene in Monrovia, the Liberian capital. You can imagine how scarce accurate information is outside Monrovia. Government and health officials there have found one way, though, to reach out to people in those more isolated areas: radio. Our producer Leo Hornack often looks at the many ways radio is used around the world, and he's been finding out how radio has become a weapon during the Ebola crisis. Leo joins us now from London. What are you hearing, Leo?
Well, I mean, the thing is, for in much of West Africa, Liberia, Sierra Leone, all the places which are affected worst by Ebola, radio is an incredibly important tool for all kinds of messages. And it's one of the only ways in which people have a sense of what's going on in the outside world and of messages. I mean, unlike TV, which requires a pretty constant electricity supply, radio can use with batteries. Unlike newspapers, which require literacy, or internet news or online news, which also require literacy, radio, you don't really need much more than a small, fairly cheap set and to be able to switch it on. So radio is the go-to for trying to spread awareness and trying to combat the kind of conspiracy theories and myths that your previous speaker was talking about. And I'd just like to play you one of the ways in which people are attempting to fight these myths, and that is through music. There has been a whole slew across the whole of the region of songs officially produced and by local artists trying to raise awareness of the fact that Ebola is real. Here's one of them.
Ebola is real. Let's protect ourselves and our family.
Yeah, all the right messages are there, Leo. Protect ourselves. That sounds right. But talk a bit about the tone, because it's either sounding unnecessarily cheerful or slightly let's join hands and up with the people. What is the tone that people are hearing?
Well, I think this is partly a cultural thing, Marco. I mean, to sort of Western ears, that sounds like quite a cheerful and positive song. And I think that there's a mix there, because they want people not only to get these very, very serious messages: the virus exists, do not touch dead bodies, even if their loved ones at a funeral, do not touch the dead body. These kind of messages, which are very, very sort of distressing messages. But they have to be done in such a way that people are interested to hear them. And they have to be done in such a way that they're going to make it into the top 40 charts in these countries. And so that's why I think, as an outsider, that there feels like maybe a bit of a mismatch. But I've been listening to these radio stations in Liberia and Sierra Leone over the last few days, and the people phoning in don't see it that way at all. People on their phone-in shows, their DJs, they're seeing this as a very powerful message and a very important message, which some of their listeners are agreeing with, but maybe not all the people who are hearing this have yet got this message.
So the composers of these songs, I mean, how do they go about actually creating a user-friendly message for a disease that's killed 1,000 people or more than 1,000 people?
Well, it's done with great care, actually, Marco. I mean, I spoke to Musa Sangeria, who of BBC Media Action, which is a charity funded partly by the BBC. And he is one of the people in Sierra Leone who is in charge of designing these messages and spreading them out to rural radio stations in particular. He explained to me that they'd even thought about the kind of voices they would use in these songs. Here's Musa.
we decided to have a female voice on the PSCs because we realized that it helps to provide some form of reassurance to people who are listening. And given the fact that the virus has largely affected women to a large extent because they are primary caregivers, so you want to use a voice that most people who are seriously affected could be able to identify themselves with.
So, as he was saying, it's even the choice of voice for these PSAs, as he calls them, public service announcements, has been very carefully thought through. And there is a grim story even to that kind of thing, because, as he was saying, unfortunately, it is predominantly women who end up caring for the sick and therefore are at greatest risk.
Leo Hornack in our office at the BBC in London. Thank you very much.
No problem, Marco.
For more of our coverage of the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, visit our special Twitter feed. Our Human Needs team shares the latest global health and development reporting from our newsroom and beyond. To follow, just go to twitter.com/PRI Human Needs. Heavily armed men pulled off a heist near Paris yesterday. There were no Impressionist masterpieces or rare jewels involved. Instead, the robbers hit a Saudi prince's motorcade that was loaded with cash and sensitive documents. We just had to call up the Paris-based reporter for the Telegraph newspaper to get more details. Henry Samuel, how did this heist go down and where did it happen?
Well, it happened on Sunday night. A convoy of 13 vehicles left one of Paris's chic hotels, the Georges V, and then moved to the north of Paris, where it was about to take the motorway to go to an airport called Le Bourget. And in a place called La Chapelle, just on the outskirts, the convoy was stopped by two vehicles, two BMWs, and a commando of around eight men jumped out, some of them wielding Kalashnikovs, and they went straight for one of the vehicles, a utility vehicle, and they drove off with its three occupants inside. And they certainly knew what they were doing, because inside was €250,000 in cash and what police are calling perhaps sensitive documents. And there's been absolutely no trace of the assailants. No one was actually hurt. So absolute mystery here.
So, as you say, I mean, they got some cash, wasn't insignificant, about $250,000, but more intriguing are those documents you were talking about.
At this stage, we don't know a lot. I mean, yes, the police did use the word potentially sensitive documents because they came from the embassy, but it doesn't look like the Saudis are giving a lot of information, certainly not to the press. So I think at the moment, not a lot of information on just how sensitive they are, but clearly these people knew exactly what they were doing, what they were looking for. Was it a kind of contract attack to get these particular documents, or was it a contract to get the money, or both? Difficult to say at this stage. What happened is two of the cars were eventually found in a village outside of Paris, burnt down. There were a few documents in Arab that hadn't burned, and also a few 500 euro notes. I don't know if that's going to help police at all, but that's all they've got to go on for the moment.
Yeah, I mean, the big question is, what were they after, the money or the documents, as you say? You know, the Saudis had not gotten their convoy onto the motorway, as you said. That means they were basically at Porte de la Chapelle, which is essentially inside the city limits of Paris. That's got to be kind of unnerving for the residents of the city.
Well, it's only about 10 minutes from my door, I can tell you. Yeah. It's in the northeast of Paris. As you say, it's right. There's the Périphérique, which is the ring road. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, in a way, it's scary, but it's so targeted that, you know, it's not as if they're spraying bullets around. They really knew exactly what they're doing. But yet, it is kind of worrying to know that there are weapons of war going around, you know, in the City of Light. And, you know, there have been other cases. I mean, there's another one in 2010, thieves carrying heavy weapons. They managed to stop the daughter of the mayor of Kiev at the time, and they got €4.5 million of worth of jewelry off her. So increasingly, it seems that the police are rather powerless to prevent these kind of surgical strikes on very rich individuals like this. Obviously, it's rather embarrassing, you know, for the security forces in Paris,
yeah,
who obviously want to welcome rich individuals.
Yes, indeed. Henry Samuel with the Telegraph newspaper in Paris. Thanks for your time.
Thanks.
This is The World on PRI Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. It's August, one last chance to grab some vacation. If you're looking for a nice, quiet island somewhere, Scotland's Isle of Col has you covered. Or not. There's no cell phone service, but maybe not for long. Corey Princell's got our story.
It's been a 3-hour ferry ride from the Scottish mainland, past cloud-covered hills and cliffs dropping into the sea. Quiet returns as the ship pulls away. And it might feel like there's nothing here on the Isle of Col. No visitor center, no taxis, and you can't pull up a map on your phone. If you had a signal on the ferry, it's disappeared. It's really just a short walk from the pier up to the village and the one hotel on the island. Julie Oliphant owns it with her husband, and on this summer afternoon, she's having a drink with some friends in the lounge. They're talking about all the smartphones they're seeing on the mainland.
We sat at a really nice restaurant in Glasgow, me and hubby, and we looked around and nobody was talking to each other. All these tables for two, and they're all texting between courses.
On the Isle of Col, people don't text. They call each other on landlines. They catch up in person. The island has a population of just over 200, too small to interest a cell phone provider. Most cell phones just don't work. And some people would like it to stay that way.
And then you can see our place from here. It's the walled garden.
Pat Graham runs a campground inside what used to be the walled garden of the island castle. On the way there, we drive, through the rain, across a rocky, treeless landscape, past windy beaches, white houses, and wandering sheep. In her living room, we settle down on the couch with Graham's three dogs piled up beside her.
You can sit somewhere on call and not see another person for a whole day, which is beautiful. It's one of these sort of places where you can just chill out and make your own life, whatever you want to do. It used to be like that, but then you're pressurized now into being modern or upbeat or whatever they want to call it.
But the upbeat is coming to call. Last year, a community group on the island began working with the Scottish government on a plan to bring mobile phone coverage to the island. It's a major priority of the Scottish government, connecting some of Scotland's most remote places through digital technology. Graham says having internet on the island has been a godsend, but phones are different. It's the thin edge of the wedge, she says, the beginning of something that might spoil everything.
I don't want to be like another island. I want Col to be Col.
On the other side of the island from Graham's campground lies Grishapul Farm.
And I'm probably the person on the island most affected by this ugly big lattice tower sticking up out of one of my rather pristine hill fields.
Alex McLean Bristol, the owner of Grishapul, has offered his land for what will soon be a 50-foot cell phone tower with 4G service. Construction has already started. The total cost is almost $300,000, mostly paid for by the Scottish government, with the community chipping in. McLean Bristol's offering his land, essentially for free.
I think they're vital for safety, for I want to be able to make phone calls when I'm out on the hill, I want to be able to use my phone when I'm out on the hill, and I think it's good for the island. It's wonderful living in the backwater in some ways, but actually, to run a business, you want to have the same tools as everyone else.
Technology, says McLean Bristol, is one of the things keeping this small island alive. Unlike some of the other remote communities in Scotland, which have aging and declining populations, the village school on Col is full of kids. It's a sign that young families see a future here.
And that is because we've embraced change for the last 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 100 years. We've moved with the times, often 20 years behind probably, but we have moved with the times. We've got to keep that on going because we don't want suddenly to discover that primary school is down to 9 people like it was when I went there.
Some of the controversy about mobile phones has been about the tower itself, the way it will look. Some don't like the amount of money being spent by the community. But some on the island say it's about more than that. Something seems to happen when people come to Col and learn they can't take calls and can't stay connected to where they came from. They get to be where they are. Julie Oliphant sees it at the hotel.
We have guests, their kids are just stuck to their phones and their internet all the time. When it doesn't work here, the parents just get all the phones, sling them in the cupboard, and they turn back into 12-year-olds and go off and play on the beach.
Today, kids are running and kicking balls around the village. It's sunny, and it seems like everyone is out.
Okay, thank you all for attending the 93rd Col Show.
The annual Col Show has been happening on the island for almost 100 years, and in many ways it hasn't changed. There are competitions for best cabbage and best black-faced sheep, races, tug-of-war, and prizes. This year, there's no one standing apart, talking on the phone or in a corner sending a text. But soon, they'll be able to. For the World, I'm Corey Princell on the Isle of Cull, Scotland.
Now, as people all over Scotland know all too well, there's a big vote coming up next month on Scottish independence from the United Kingdom. Yes or no? One place where the referendum has piqued a lot of interest is France. It has a special relationship with Scotland dating back to the 13th century. That's when the two nations signed the Old Alliance as protection against their common enemy, England. So does the alliance still hold up? Our BBC colleague Hugh Schofield reports that it's complicated.
What is a Scottish pipe band doing raiding in July through a town in central France? Well, this is Aubigny-sur-Nère, a town with a special history because for many centuries it essentially belonged to the Scots. In 1422, the castle here was given as a reward to John Stuart of Darnley for his help fighting with the French king against the English. And today they still mark the memory of those days here with a two-day Scottish festival. It's a modern-day echo of the Old Alliance, as Rémi Béguin, Aubigny Town Hall's cultural specialist, explains.
The Old Alliance was a military and also, well, we could say some kind of romantic alliance between France and Scotland. Well, nowadays it still survives because there are still many links between France and Scotland, and French people love Scotland and Scottish people love France. So it's like a couple. It's working. There is some kind of magic between France and Scotland.
There's haggis here, and the whiskey flows with the wine. Emotionally, the affection for things Scottish runs deep. And when it comes to independence, well, the compere put the question to the crowd. Were they in favour? Knee-jerk popular support is one thing, though deeper down, people are rather more circumspect about Scottish independence. Certainly in government circles in Paris, independence is not the preferred option. Mainly that's because France believes in Europe, and European Union, France says, should mean taking down borders, not creating new ones. For the political scientist Dominique Moisy, what the French want is a strong, united kingdom inside Europe to balance the growing might of the Germans.
The French want as strong a united kingdom as possible. The dream of the Scots are antithetical to the ambitions of the French for Europe.
Freedom for Scotland appeals to French hearts, less to their heads.
That report there from the BBC's Hugh Schofield. You're listening to The World on PRI. I'm Marco Werman. Panamanian salsa musician Ruben Blades took a gamble. He turned some of his songs into tangos and then played them for an expert audience in Argentina.
The fact that we were allowed to leave the country alive made me feel somewhat optimistic.
So did Blades nail it or blow it? Find out just ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're listening to The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. From the land of Saddam Hussein to the land of Shakespeare and back. That's the story behind Nadim Zahawi, born in Iraq and fled the country during Saddam Hussein's reign. Zahawi grew up with his family in England, and today Zahawi is a member of the British Parliament representing the district of Stratford-on-Avon. Today, though, we caught up with Nadim Zahawi in his native home of Iraqi Kurdistan, where he's on a fact-finding mission in Erbil. Mr. Zahawi told me he's very relieved to hear about American support for the Kurdish forces known as the Peshmerga.
I have a very good friend who is the frontline commander of the Kurdish army, the Peshmerga. He rang to say that our situation here on the front line was precarious, but he wasn't sure whether he was going to be able to hold on. I was pleased that the US government reacted so swiftly to safeguard Erbil, and of course to go further now, where we're hearing that the Mosul Dam has been retaken by the Kurdish and the Iraqi forces working together.
Now, this friend of yours, the Peshmerga commander, when you and he talk privately, what are his big concerns right now?
Well, his biggest concern is needing that equipment on the front line very quickly. And in the longer term, they need better training and coordination. They've had many years where Prime Minister Maliki in Baghdad effectively cut them off. So they had none of the equipment that was left behind by the U.S. military. They had none of the training that they would have needed.
Yeah, and all of that would point to a Western involvement greater than just airstrikes and leaving military hardware with the Peshmerga. Do you think the West has an obligation to join the fight, actually get boots on the ground?
Well, that's interesting because they do not want to see our boys and girls, our men and women, whether they are American or British or other international community, on the front line fighting this fight for them. They absolutely believe that they have the wherewithal to fight this fight if they get those components in place.
And yet many people, some of President Obama's harshest critics, say the U.S. and the West can't just let ISIS continue its advances. It needs to do something more than just airstrikes.
Well, if you were here on the ground, you would witness that those airstrikes have been the pivotal factor in helping the Peshmerga, the Kurdish forces, and the Iraqi forces push ISIS back. Coupled with that, we need to intensify our diplomatic efforts to create an inclusive government that Kurds, Sunni Arabs, Turkmens, Yazidis, Christians, the majority Shia community all feel that they are part of and they have some skin in that game. Because without that, you will never, ever remove ISIS out of any society.
I'm just curious, you still have family in the region, Mr. Zahawi?
Not direct family. My family are in the United Kingdom and Germany and other parts of Europe. I have many, many friends here in Kurdistan. And of course, I will never deny my heritage and my ancestry, which is why I feel that I needed to be here to see for myself what is happening so I can report back to my parliament.
And you represent Stratford-on-Avon in England, the quiet and storied little community of Stratford-on-Avon. Just as an aside, it must make you wonder sometimes, how did I end up in such a lovely little part of the world when the place I came from is so different?
I pinch myself every morning as to how lucky I am that my father decided to flee Iraq in the 70s, before anyone knew of the Ba'ath Party or Saddam Hussein, and decided to bring us to England to give us security and safety. I am humbled that they have chosen a Kurdish immigrant born in Baghdad as their representative.
Nadeem Zahawi, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
President Obama gave an update this afternoon on the situation in Iraq. He specifically mentioned the fight for control of that strategic Mosul Dam.
Today, with our support, Iraqi and Kurdish forces took a major step forward by recapturing the largest dam in Iraq near the city of Mosul. The Mosul Dam fell under terrorist control earlier this month and is directly tied to our objective of protecting Americans in Iraq. If that dam was breached, it could have proven catastrophic, with floods that would have threatened the lives of thousands of civilians and endanger our embassy compound in Baghdad.
The Mosul Dam is, in fact, of enormous strategic importance. I want to unpack that now with Azam Alwash. He's a civil engineer based in Erbil and an expert on water in Iraq. And he says the Mosul Dam is a critical resource for the region and the country.
It is the largest dam in Iraq. The reservoir capacity is about 11 billion cubic meters. That's about 12 billion yards. It's a heck of a lot of water.
And all that water is used to provide two key services, irrigation and hydroelectricity. Awash says all the cities south of Mosul that are on the Tigris River depend on this dam. If you really want to understand just how important this dam is for Iraq as a whole, you have to go back to the 1990s. That's when Turkey started building its own dams on the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, leaving less water for its Iraqi neighbors to the south.
So we have a lot less water coming into Iraq on the Tigris. And more importantly, the quality of water is deteriorating.
So the Mosul Dam was built to address those two problems, poor water quality and just less water altogether. But it was always an imperfect solution, because this is a dam that takes a lot of upkeep.
United States Army Corps of Engineers report designated Mosul Dam as the most dangerous dam in the world.
Awash tells me the Mosul Dam rests on a layer of gypsum, and gypsum dissolves as water percolates through it. As soon as they started filling the reservoir, the foundation of the Mosul Dam began to cave. So ever since 1982, workers at the dam have been constantly grouting the holes and cracks with cement. And that's why experts like Azam Alawash are worried about the recent battles for control of the dam.
Because if the grouting operations that have been going on 24/7 since 1982 is interrupted, you're going to have gaping holes underneath the foundations of this dam, which will cause settlement.
And settlement creates more cracks.
And the cracks will become a breach of the dam, releasing the reservoir water in a tsunami-like wave.
Awash says the water could flood the city of Mosul within 3 hours and reach Baghdad in 3 or 4 days. That's why he calls the dam a ticking time bomb. Not only could militants decide to blow it up, if the dam is simply not maintained, it could breach in as little as 3 months. But there's still that other age-old concern as well, water scarcity. Awash says if the Islamic State militants were to retain control of the Mosul Dam, they could run the tap dry by using too much water.
We don't want to lose too much water, because if we operated haphazardly the way, say, ISIS has operated Tabaka Dam in Syria, we could run out of water. We could be looking at a very severe drought next year. We don't want that either.
Azam Alwash there, a civil engineer in Erbil. His bottom line, it's important to make sure that the Mosul Dam is once again under the control of the Iraqi government. One of Iraqi's big fears is civil war. It's happening in Syria, it's sort of happening in Libya, and even before the Arab Spring, it had happened in Algeria throughout the 1990s, and Algerians do not want another civil war, which is partly why the government works carefully to keep any mention of the brutal civil war in Algeria to a minimum, even if artists want to address it in their work. Some Algerian artists are figuring out how to get around that, though. Here's reporter Asia Bundawi in Algiers.
Here at an apartment in the trendy Algiers neighborhood of Tlemcen, a dozen young artists are gathered. Some are frustrated. Walid Haidoud is an artist and graphic designer based in Algiers. He's helped launch an artist collective called Box 24 out of his apartment. It's one of the few independent spaces for art in the country, and a response to the Ministry of Culture's monopoly over the art scene.
We're sick of art in Algeria being stuck or being portrayed in Orientalist ways. Images of camels and deserts, sheikhs with their harems. Many Algerian artists are creating contemporary art. This exists here.
You see, the ministry owns and operates nearly all of the exhibition space in the country. And while the government regularly hosts expensive, flashy exhibitions of well-known Algerian artists, it's almost completely ignored young artists and contemporary art. And subjects like corruption, unemployment, and the frustrations of youth in Algeria are passed over. Meanwhile, in 2012, the ministry's budget was a whopping $450 million. Zainab Sadida is an award-winning artist who's been dubbed the Grand Dame of the Algerian art scene.
So there is huge money in culture, but it's not the young artists who's getting it.
She's exhibited in Ministry of Culture-sponsored exhibitions, but says that a new generation of artists aren't being supported. Their work is rarely shown in museums, they don't get public funding, and the once-renowned art school in Algiers has grown dilapidated with neglect. And while artists like Zainab Sadida, Walid Haidoud, and others are working hard to create independent spaces for art, what's still missing in Algiers is an independent art economy.
The three fundamentals are museums, artists, and collectors, and not to mention galleries.
Taymour Gran owns his own gallery in New York City, one of the only galleries in the U.S. exhibiting Algerian artists.
Tunis has galleries. I know the cities of Morocco have galleries. Egypt has galleries. But I think Algiers is definitely lacking a gallery. And a gallery to take their artists to art fairs and expose. And Algeria has been closed for so long. I think that's affected the way artists produce work.
Grant couldn't be more right. When Algerian artist Amina Minya couldn't find exhibition space to show her work, she decided to take her art outdoors.
So for me, the best thing was to go in the streets, to go in the public space, to meet the people. I mean, for me, it was really fundamental.
Minya is an internationally exhibited artist who lives and works in Algiers, though she's made a name for herself internationally. She set out to create large-scale urban installations on the site of the government's never-ending subway construction project in Algiers, but she ran into constant bureaucratic hurdles with the authorities. In controlling spaces for art, the ministry is also essentially deciding what qualifies as art and what doesn't.
For them, artwork is only oil on canvas or sculptures, you know, in a classical, very classical manner. I can't continue with an unseen artwork. And for me, it's a very big frustration to be in London, in Paris, and not exhibiting here.
And so Amina and any other young Algerian artists addressing topics that make the government uncomfortable or challenge the established artistic norms have to confront the reality that their work may never be seen, at least not in Algeria. For The World, I'm Asya Bundawi in Algiers.
Tomorrow, Asya introduces us to some artists who are trying to tackle Algeria's civil war in their work. They're calling attention to what's known as the Black Decade, despite the Algerian government's taboo against discussing it.
Even when they try to remember it, they remember it to forget it.
Young artists unpacking the trauma and scars of Algeria's recent past. That's tomorrow here on The World. Here's a challenging question for you. What animal makes this sound? Yeah, if you're stumped, don't take it personally. For a long time, experts thought these creatures were completely mute, not to mention deaf as well. But researchers in Brazil have been committing that conventional wisdom to the thing of myth. The animals in question are turtles, and the researchers are now recording the sound of turtles talking to each other. Here's another sample from a giant South American river turtle. Richard Vogt is one of the scientists on the project. He's a turtle expert at the National Institute for Amazon Research in Manaus, the capital city of the Brazilian state of Amazonas.
The turtles are vocalizing at the lower end of the human audible spectrum, at low frequencies, like whales. I don't mean the sounds are like the sounds whales make, but they're low frequency, like whales and dolphins, because low frequency sounds travel farther in water.
But here's the thing, Vogt says. Turtles are not exactly chatty. Researchers would be listening sometimes for hours before they captured a single short phrase from one of them. And what do turtles talk about? Vogt says he's still gathering evidence, but it's pretty clear that frequent topics are where to migrate, where to nest, and when to flee from danger.
Turtles were often thought to be kind of obtuse animals that just kind of clunked around in a shell and didn't have any social life. What we're showing is that they're very social animals. They talk to each other. They decide where they're going. I mean, there are published papers of finding, you know, hundreds of turtles hibernating under one bank. How did they all get there? It isn't by chance. They got there because they were talking to each other. The behavior of turtles is much more complex than people thought before.
Vogt says we've opened up a Pandora's box. Now conservationists and researchers will have to consider the impact of noise pollution on certain species of turtles, and even before they hatch. Because it turns out some turtles are pretty vocal, even when they're still inside the egg. This is The World on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TiVo. No need to switch TV inputs, remotes, or interfaces to access cable TV and streaming from Netflix and Hulu Plus. Learn more at TiVo.com.
I'm Marco Werman. You're tuned to The World. Brazil is famous for its dramatic TV soap operas, but that sort of drama is nothing compared to the latest plot twists in the country's presidential election. Socialist Party candidate Eduardo Campos was killed last week in a plane crash. His running mate, environmentalist Marina Silva, is now poised to replace him. And while Campos had been running a distant third in the polls, the latest survey shows Silva seriously threatening to derail the re-election of Brazil's sitting president. Reporter Ben Tavener in Sao Paulo is covering the story.
There's been a fair amount of hysteria around the crash. People said that they couldn't believe what had happened. As you say, it seemed like the plot of a novella that we have here. And it's really, it has shocked some people. I mean, I think this latest poll that we've seen does show that it's been a game changer. And not only in terms of who people are going to vote for, but in terms of people deciding to get involved in the elections. That we've seen a big change in the number of people that said that they were going to spoil their vote or not vote at all, to have now decided to pick a side. So those battle lines that were being drawn ahead of this very tragic event, those battle lines now seem more blurred than ever, and they're going to have to be redrawn before that election takes place.
Yeah, so who is Marina Silva? She's the woman who's now likely to fill the shoes of Eduardo Campos, who died last Wednesday. Why are some people in these polls kind of attracted to her?
Well, the first thing to say is that she's done it before. She was the third place candidate in the first round of the elections in 2010 when Dilma Rousseff, the incumbent, ran against her. Marina Silva, her background is in the environment. That's the biggest thing that she's really known for. The last time she ran for the Green Party here in Brazil. She comes from an Amazon state. She was an environmentalist. She was a colleague of the very famous Chico Mendes, who was an environmentalist who was very well known for defending the Amazon. He was assassinated. And then she went on to become part of the Workers' Party, which is the party that Dilma Rousseff and President Lula a part of. Until 2009, she served actually as a senator and then became environment minister under Lula. But she had a big falling out with the party, exactly the same as it should be pointed out, as Eduardo Campos, the candidate that died last week. They were both fairly tight under the Workers' Party and then both decided to go their separate ways.
And lest anyone think otherwise, Marina Silva is not related to former President Lula da Silva. As far as her former running mate, the late Eduardo Campos, why is she doing so much better in the polls than he was? I mean, is it kind of instant sympathy support in the days after his death?
I think there is that, but we should first make the point that she's well known. In fact, nationally, she's far better known than Eduardo Campos ever was. He was really at the beginning of his political life, although he had a lot of politics behind him. So she's just better known. And we are once again in the position where the two top candidates in this election are women. And as this poll showed today, she is currently within the error of margin drawing with Dilma in that second round. It's looking very likely that this election will go to a second round. And if she did win, she would be Brazil's first black president.
She's an evangelical, also a Green Party member. It seems a little incongruous. How could her faith impact her campaign?
Well, Dilma Rousseff has been trying to score votes from evangelical voters, which are making up an increasingly large chunk of the population here, where polls taken 15, 20 years ago showed that Catholics in the country were around 85%. It's now showing that that number is dropping and the number of evangelical people in the country is going to about 30%. So this is a major chunk of the electorate. And you know, as that battle line had been drawn by Dilma before, Maria Silva, there is no battle with her. She is the clear evangelical candidate. We should, of course, say that she is not yet the official candidate for the PSD party. That is what we're expecting later this week. But I mean, after this poll, it seems like it's a foregone conclusion. They would be pretty mad not to go with such a strong candidate.
Reporter Ben Tavener speaking with me from Sao Paulo about Marina Silva. Thanks very much.
Very welcome.
Brazil's music has been globally influential, and our final guest today has said he's been one of the beneficiaries of Brazilian music. But Panamanian musician Ruben Blades, you may call him Ruben Blades, he's best known for his salsa compositions, like this 1988 gem called Juana Mayo. Blades has made a career out of tunes like that, but all along, it seems, he was fantasizing about something else.
I've always wondered how the songs that I wrote that were recorded in salsa, how would they turn out if I recorded them as tangos?
Not exactly the closest of genres, salsa and tango. I mean, where do you even start?
If you do something like Juana Mayo, and you're doing it, Juana Mayo, ave de la madrugada, de tristeza disfrazada. con perfumes y carmín. If you do it in tango, it would be Juan Amayo. Ave de la madrugada, de tristeza disfrazada, con perfumes y carmín.
Take that to the recording studio, and you get this.
Juan Amayo, donde anónimos señores sacan a pasear dolores a un jardín de soledad.
In fact, Ruben Blades has a new album out where he gives a tango treatment to 10 of his classic songs. He says it's not just the time signature that's different, but the phrasing and emotion too.
It was very difficult, actually, to sing the songs. I had to be very careful not to allow my emotions to take over and then turn the song into something too dramatic or even false.
He also had to watch out for the critics. Blades says a lot of people were skeptical about his tango project, but he persevered, and before even entering that recording studio, he tested his reworked songs in front of the toughest tango audience in the world.
We performed the songs for the first time live in Buenos Aires during the World Tango Music Exhibition. We played it at the Luna Park, full audience, over 11,000 people, and it was televised through the whole country. So the fact that we were allowed to leave the country alive made me feel somewhat optimistic.
Yep, when staying alive is a sign of a successful focus group. After the success of that show, Ruben Blades knew he had to lay down the tracks. We'll leave you with another taste from his new CD, Tango, a song called Pedro Navaja. And you can watch a video of Ruben Blades performing this song earlier this summer at the Hollywood Bowl. That's at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening.
Por la esquina del viejo barrio lo vi pasar con el tumbao que tienen los guapos al caminar. Las manos siempre en los bolsillos.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported in part by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include the Tagney Jones Family Fund and the Rose Family Fund. By the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org. By the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael V. and Anne Cerisi, the Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the Ford Foundation, and by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.